Blog Talk Radio.
Trump, his announcement yesterday on the war in Afghanistan, terrible, absolutely terrible, incredible. I'm going to talk about that just in a second here. I got to lead with that story. I'll give you a quick little rundown of what you have to look forward to. The Guardian does a terrific profile on a low-wage worker in Kansas, and you learn a little bit about, you know, the insane struggle that they go through and why they're fighting for $15 an hour. You have some right-wing author, I should say, who is making the case that liberalism is worse for minorities than segregation. This argument is being made in the year 2017. Isn't that lovely? And then we have cops planting evidence on people. Uh-oh. So, it's a lot of stuff today. I tried to get to this story yesterday on Saudi Arabia and Yemen, and didn't have enough time, but today I will have enough time, and that's a very, very important story that we're going to talk about a little bit later on. So, a lot of bad news to discuss, and we're going to lead with probably the worst of all the news, Afghanistan. So let's get started. President Trump made a big announcement last night. The announcement is that we are staying in Afghanistan. So we're going to send at least 4,000 more troops there. He also hinted at some sort of escalation with Pakistan. He kept bringing them up in the context of, they have to do more, tremendous. He does the same thing when it comes to North Korea with China, basically trying to say, yeah, they have to do more, believe me. So this is, you know, kind of standard Trump at this point. You prod people who are more closely linked with the country in question, and then you also escalate yourself. In the case of Afghanistan, again, it's going to be at least 4,000 more troops. Now, he didn't bring up a specific troop number in his speech, but you have various media outlets that ran with the number 4,000. Why did they run with that number? Because that's what the White House told them. So remember, one of Trump's most ridiculous, well, he's got a lot of ridiculous moments on the campaign trail, but one of the things that had us all face-palming even before he ran for office was when he used to say, I have a super secret plan to defeat ISIS, and here's what I do. I would never share it, because once you share it, ISIS knows about it, and so you have to have the element of surprise, so you don't tell people your plans. So in his speech, he didn't mention a troop number, because he wants to still be able to say, I didn't tell them my plans. But he leaked it to the media through the back channel. The White House leaked the number, which is about 4,000 troops. So he was contemplating for a while maybe privatizing the war in Afghanistan. Oh, well, that's great. It turns out he was convinced to not do that, but he still is going to escalate the troop levels. There are reports that General McMaster showed Trump pictures of the 1970s in Afghanistan when girls were wearing miniskirts and they were more free, that he used that to say, see, we can win in Afghanistan. We can make people more free. We could go back to a situation like this. Of course, that's hilariously ironic, because the reality is it was the United States arming and funding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan that was, partially, if not directly, responsible for the descent of Afghanistan into the current situation that it's in right now. So we armed the Mujahideen. They broke up and became the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And then they came after us with the weapons that we gave them. We were arming them because they were fighting the big bad Soviet Union. So we arm the fundamentalists, and then we turn around and say, I can't believe they're fundamentalists. We got to fix this. Well, you know, it seems to me like when you partially created the problem, you're probably not the best people to fix it. You know, that crazy idea, this is something Trump used to believe, but he doesn't anymore. So here's why this is so disheartening. John Schwartz and Robert Mackey of The Intercept took a look at all of Trump's comments on Afghanistan, so what his position used to be on Afghanistan. And there's never been a human being on the planet more concrete and straightforward and direct about their opinion on an issue before than Trump was on Afghanistan. Take a look at some of this. In 2013, he said, "Do not allow our very stupid leaders to sign a deal that keeps us in Afghanistan through 2024. With all caused by USA. Make America great again. We have wasted an enormous amount of blood and treasure in Afghanistan. Their government has zero appreciation. Let's get out. We should leave Afghanistan immediately. No more wasted lives. If we have to go back in, we go in hard and quick. Rebuild the U.S. first. I agree with President Obama on Afghanistan. We should have a speedy withdrawal. Why should we keep wasting our money? Rebuild the U.S. Let's get out of Afghanistan. Our troops are being killed by the Afghanis we train, and we waste billions there. Nonsense! Rebuild the USA! Karzai of Afghanistan is not sticking with our signed agreement. They are dropping us like dopes. Get out now and rebuild US! 84% of US troops wounded and 70% of our brave men and women killed in Afghanistan have all come under Obama. Time to get out of there! Why are we continuing to train these Afghanis who then shoot our soldiers in the back? Afghanistan is a complete waste. Time to come home." Here's some more in 2012, he said. "It is time to get out of Afghanistan. We are building roads and schools for people that hate us. It is not in our national interests." 2011, he said, "When will we stop wasting our money on rebuilding Afghanistan? We must rebuild our country first." Now, if that wasn't clear enough, even though obviously to anybody by the first two tweets, you went, I got it. Okay, I see exactly what he believes and exactly what he's pushing for. And by the way, he said this on the campaign trail, too. It wasn't like, oh, well, you're going back to this episode earlier before you were president. No, he said this back then, and he said this on the campaign trail. He repeatedly said, was the only Republican who said, we got to rebuild. What are we doing? We got to rebuild our country here. We got airports that look like third world countries. Rebuild our country here. Stop wasting money overseas. That's what I'm going to do. Make America great again. America first. Remember that? America first. What happened to America first? Apparently it's a Kandahar first now, or Kabul first now. You fucking two-faced bitch. But here's the best for last. Donald Trump making comments, I believe this one as well was in 2012. Let's watch.
Afghanistan is a total and complete disaster. What are we doing? We have all of these horrible events taking place there. We can't even run our own country. We don't build our schools. We don't build our highways. We don't build anything anymore. What's wrong with us? What's wrong with our leadership? And now we have Afghanistan, where a man loses his mind and goes around on a killing spree, and the world hates us for it. What is going on? Money should be spent in our country. We should rebuild our country. And we should also, by the way, reduce our $16 trillion in debt. Let's get with it. Get out of Afghanistan. We've wasted billions and billions of dollars, and more importantly, thousands and thousands of lives, not to mention all of these young men and women that come home and they really have problems. Let's go. Let's get with it. We need leaders that know what they're doing.
Nobody was ever more right on an issue than Trump was about Afghanistan until now. He is probably the most public voice, save maybe like Ron Paul, but the most public voice against staying in Afghanistan, and he was that for a very long time. And then now that he's president and he can actually do something about it, does a 180, takes the opposite position. So there's only a few options here. Either he's not really in control. He's a deep state puppet, if you will. So the generals and the neocons are really running everything, and he's just a figurehead, pretty horrible figurehead, clearly, if that's the case. That's an option. Another option is he's a liar. He's just a liar. He never really believed any of the shit he ever said. And then another option is he's an idiot. He's an idiot who was convinced by incredibly poor arguments. You know, he feels, oh, I'm president now, I gotta put on my big boy pants. Yeah, I'm gonna put on my big boy pants and I'm gonna do the same bullshit establishment garbage that everybody else does. We've had two presidents now who ran at least partly, because Trump was a mixed bag, he contradicted himself on many issues. Afghanistan, he never contradicted himself. But for other interventions, he contradicted himself a bunch. But you had Obama and you had Trump who ran, at least to an extent, on non-intervention. Obama took office with two wars going on. He left with two wars still going on and another five interventions on top of it. Wow. Trump said a lot of stuff. We'll rebuild the country, rebuild here, and stop nation building overseas. What happened since he's got in office? We're still doing interventions in seven different places. He escalated many of them, got rid of the rules of engagement in Somalia, for example, for our drone strikes and whatnot. And now he's escalating further in Afghanistan. And where's the infrastructure bill, by the way? Where is it? We got to rebuild our country, which is why I'm proposing to not rebuild our country and to keep wasting billions of dollars. And actually, wrong, trillions of dollars overseas. This is, Afghanistan is a multi-trillion dollar money pit. The war in Iraq, $7 trillion money pit. We just covered the story the other day. $1 trillion every year is what it costs to maintain our empire. $1 trillion with all of our wars and all of our bases and all the intelligence apparatus and the Pentagon, $1 trillion every year. Our infrastructure gets a grade of D+. We don't have clean water in Flint, Michigan, among many other places. We got half the country makes $30,000 a year or less. We have over 50,000 homeless veterans, over 400,000 homeless Americans, millions of working poor people. We don't have a living wage as the minimum wage. We don't have health care for everybody. 45,000 people die every year because they don't have access to basic health care. Along comes Fuckface McGee, arguing, we got to rebuild our country. What are we wasting our money for overseas? What are we wasting our money for overseas? Oh, I got elected and I'm now president. Where do I sign to make us waste more money overseas? He has no core. He has no principles. He has no values. He's an empty shell of a human being. That's what he is. So when that's the case, you could be controlled easily. You can be convinced easily in one direction or another. And he abandoned everything he used to say about this issue. And that's why, by the way, corporate media is praising him. Corporate media is praising him. I can't tell you how many tweets I've seen and how many things have been on the news about, no, he's acting really presidential now. That's what it is. So all it takes for the otherwise hostile corporate media to love Trump is for him to start bombing more shit overseas. It happened with Syria, remember? Everybody was shitting on Trump, and oh my God, he's crazy, and he's a loose cannon, and he's this, and he's that, which is all true. But then when he started launching cruise missiles at Syrian government air bases, which, by the way, is acting as al-Qaeda and ISIS's air force, because the Syrian government is fighting al-Qaeda and ISIS, all of a sudden, they're like, oh, so tonight's the night he became president. That was very presidential of him. So he's an unhinged, crazy maniac who we shouldn't trust with the nuclear red button, but we love it when he bombs other stuff. That makes no fucking sense. Same thing. Corporate media, oh, very presidential. raising troop levels and bombing things very presidential. So, for those of you who don't know, there was a poll done in 2013. Only 17% of the American people still wanted to be there. That was in 2013. I haven't seen a poll on that since then. You would think that's a poll that people should do, I don't know, maybe every month. Hey, do you still want to have your tax dollars going to fight a war where nobody's even defining victory anymore? Seems like a pretty, you know, something that the American people should be directly involved in. Oh, we're paying for this garbage, for this nonsense? I mean, I haven't seen a poll since then. It was 17% back then, which means we should get out immediately back then. But I venture to guess it's probably even half that now. It's not like it's getting more popular. We've just wasted more money, had more Americans die, had more civilians on the Afghanistan side die. And by the way, when we went in there, what was the argument made? Oh, I mean, well, we got to get Al-Qaeda. We got to get them out. I mean, they attacked us on 9/11. Okay, mission accomplished. There's no more Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Literally, that's not just me saying it. That's not just some, you know, code pink or whatever saying it. No, that's our own intelligence apparatus says that. Yeah, there's no more Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Okay, why the fuck are you there? Why are you there?
Well, you see, after what happened with 9/11, we got to kill Osama bin Laden.
Don't know if you know this. He's done. He's dead. To steal from my buddy Justin Timberlake, he's dead and gone. So what the fuck are you still doing there? It's the same shit they do with Iraq.
Well, yeah, Saddam says he was one who was responsible for 9/11. He's working with Al-Qaeda and whatnot.
Okay, he's dead too. So why are you still there?
Well, you know, Saddam was a bad guy.
Right, but he's dead.
He had weapons of mass destruction.
He's dead. He's gone. What are you fuck you talking about? What are you doing there? Perhaps it's not about all the shit that they tell us it's about. Perhaps there's tremendous mineral wealth in Afghanistan, and that's something we want to make sure we have access to. Perhaps their opium crop is, you know, something that we're interested in. Perhaps natural resources is one of the main reasons we're involved in a lot of different places. Maybe that's what's going on. Oh, no, you're not allowed to say that. You're not allowed to say that. I'm sure we have 900 military bases all around the world, and we have, and we're best friends with Saudi frickin' Arabia, who has the worst human rights record of any country, because we love human rights and we're trying to uphold human rights. This is so disgusting, man. We've wasted trillions of dollars, countless lives, for nothing. We've been there 16 years. The fuck do you think is going to happen?
17th year's a charm. That's it. It'll be a charm, 17th year.
This is crazy. There are people, there are teenagers who have never known the U.S. not at war. To a 15-year-old, they go, what do you mean? That's what we do. We're always at war. They don't think anything of it. You know, war is a thing. We're supposed to be like, whoa, the country's at war? What the fuck? That's supposed to be a last resort. Not something you jump to and, whatever, we just stay there forever. But there are 15-year-olds in the country right now who think, like, yeah, what do you mean? I've never known us not being at war. It's a waste of money. It's a waste of lives. It's counterproductive. It creates more enemies. The Taliban controls 40% of Afghanistan right now. Has there ever been a more epic failure? We've been there all this time. The Taliban controls 40%. What the fuck do you think is going to happen?
If we stay there longer, we're going to beat them back, and they will only hold 38% of the land.
And then what do you think is going to happen? If you leave in 10 years or 20 years or 100 years, they're going to take over more territory when you leave. It's either you rip off the Band-Aid now and make it quick, or you rip it off later. And even if you rip it off now, it ain't quick, bitch. You've already been there for 16 years. It's not even to say, and the polls show this, that Afghanistan is now more unpopular than Vietnam was, which is crazy when you think about it. But it's not even fair to say Afghanistan is like Vietnam now. It's more fair to say Vietnam is like Afghanistan. You know, people say, oh, Vietnam, it's like, oh, our blunder. No, it's like our Afghanistan, our blunder. Vietnam is like Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not like Vietnam. He used to say the right things. He used to believe the right things. Now he's president. Now he's doing the exact opposite. What a vapid, vacuous, empty, immoral, unethical loser. That's what Donald Trump is. He has no core. He has no set of beliefs. He's just adrift in the wind, in the D.C. elite establishment bubble. And by the way, Bannon's gone. Probably the only non-interventionist voice in the administration. He's horrible in other ways. Pretty openly racist. But in terms of foreign policy, one of the only non-interventionist voices. And now look at that. Further escalation. Oh, man. When it appears hopeless, we have to fight twice as hard. So, Justice Democrats are the answer. You guys know that. We talk about it all the time. But we have to get people elected who are going to... You want to talk about resistance? Resist on this. We just told you. Tim Kaine the other day, we covered the story. He's like, we should stay in Afghanistan. Most Senate Democrats are like, yeah, I secretly agree with this one. So, where's the opposition? The opposition is only, we think you're Vladimir Putin's puppet or something. Yeah. Wow. There's strong resistance. You guys are really fighting on serious things. Here's where you need to resist. And the Democrats are nowhere to be found. Corporate media is nowhere to be found. They're heaping praise on them. Justice Democrats are the answer. Go to justicedemocrats.com/platform. Read what we're about. Go to justicedemocrats.com/fight to donate, to get our candidates in there. We got to take down this ineffectual, disgusting Democratic Party, and really this system that's run by corporate Democrats and Republicans. It's run by elites totally disconnected from the pain, the suffering of the average family, working people, and they're blowing our tax money on stuff like this in the process. It doesn't get any worse than this, man. This is really a dark day in American history. Okay. Okay, let me do a quick one before we take our first break. Do the Barron Trump story. There's a writer for the right-wing publication, The Daily Caller, named Ford Springer. And he wrote a weird article that went after Barron Trump. That's the president's 11-year-old son. It's titled, "It's High Time Barron Trump Starts Dressing Like He's in the White House." Okay, fuckface, let's see what he has to say. "I've been on the Barron Trump train," what, "from the start, but it's about time the president's son starts dressing the part. Barron is the youngest son of Donald Trump and the only child the president shares with Melania. Time and time again, Barron has proved that he's just a normal 11-year-old kid, despite the fact that his dad is the president of the United States and he lives in the White House. One thing that isn't normal, though, is the way he dresses when he joins his parents for a public appearance. Barron was returning to the White House from New Jersey on Sunday, and while the president and first lady traveled in their Sunday best, young Barron looked like he was hopping on Air Force One for a trip to the movie theater. Think about how many times your parents forced you to dress up when you were a kid for a special occasion. No matter how hard you resisted, it was inevitable. You weren't leaving the house until you had your tie tied, your shirt tucked in nice and neat with your hair combed, and a blazer on. That's not how it goes for the president's youngest child. Donald Trump and Melania always depart the White House looking their best. The president wore a fine tailored suit, and Melania wore an elegant dress just as jaw-dropping as the last. But then Barron steps out in a t-shirt, khaki shorts, and some suede loafers. What am I missing here? Is Barron just better than I ever was at rebelling against my parents? Yeah, I put the blazer on and tie on and comb my hair and all that. But as soon as my mom turned her head, you better believe I was messing my hair up and loosening my tie. Hell, I might even undo a couple buttons on my shirt if I was feeling like a real badass. Barron doesn't have to worry about all that, but he should. His dad is always looking dapper, and his mom has become a worldwide fashion icon since becoming first lady. The youngest Trump doesn't have any responsibilities as the president's son, but the least he could do is dress the part when he steps out in public." I think I just got Ebola reading that. What what the fuck are you babbling about, son? He's an 11-year-old kid. And this guy's mad that he wasn't wearing a suit when he was coming off of an airplane after a flight on his way back from vacation. You're outraged. You're angry that an 11-year-old isn't wearing a suit after a flight on his way back from vacation. Can you imagine being this guy? And his name is even preposterous. What is it? Ford Springer? I mean, you're like a walking advertisement or something. Your parents named you to worship at the altar of free market capitalism. What a loser. He's an 11-year-old kid, dude. Relax. But this actually goes to show you something about the far right. The far right, they view social norms and politeness as morality. They view tradition as morality. So, God forbid you, like, curse in public or something, they clutch their pearls. Oh! Goodness gracious! How dare you use such naughty language in front of us respectable human beings? Now, by the way, you could see that this was reflected during the campaign, during the primary, the Republican primary, when a Republican group that was against Trump literally ran an ad of just Trump cursing. The whole ad was just Trump using bad language. Now, in their minds, they go, see, we're highlighting how immoral this guy is. But in the minds of, you know, average Americans, they were like, mm-hmm, I like that. I curse too. He's telling it like it is. That's what he's doing. But to the establishment right, the elitist right, that's like the ultimate immoral and unethical act is using naughty language, or God forbid, you're not dressed properly for the occasion. I'm a golfer. I've been to some of these, you know, very high-level private courses when I was younger. You know, I've had friends and their families, members at these places. And God forbid, you know, you weren't allowed to wear shorts at some of them until recently. Talking about 100-degree weather and dudes are walking around in full-length khakis. So, and they look at you like, oh, look at this degenerate. He's wearing shorts. That is unbelievably gross. Like, that's the stuff that they get outraged by. Now tell them that their country just invaded another country that didn't attack us, and they're like, yeah, well, what's the problem? I don't see that as immoral. I don't see that as unethical. What? We're torturing people at Guantanamo Bay? We have extrajudicial prisons? We don't believe in due process and habeas corpus anymore? Yeah, that's fine. Where's the problem? So in other words, actual immorality, violations of human rights, that's fine when we do it. That's no biggie. We're the good guys no matter what, so that's fine. But God forbid you don't, you know, dress proper or you curse. Oh, how impolite you are, sir. I'm appalled by your atrocious actions today. So they're just stupid, is the point I'm trying to get at. Their moral meter, their moral compass, is just broken. They were just raised shitty, and they act shitty, where they think things are immoral when they're not, and they get outraged over things that they shouldn't get outraged by. And they, when there's something they should actually get outraged by, they're nowhere to be found. They're fine with it. So you get the clearest example of that in this article, and that's why I wanted to cover this article. He's going after an 11-year-old kid for not wearing a suit when he's getting off a plane for coming back from vacation. If that doesn't show you how deranged and warped the overall mentality is, and this guy's view is when it comes to what's right and wrong, nothing will. Because these are the same kinds of people who write articles talking about how the war in Iraq was awesome and we should keep torturing and isn't that great. And war crimes, schwar crimes when we commit them. Who cares? It's fine when we do it. It shows you how broken these people are as human beings. So get off Barron's ass. He's an 11-year-old kid. I don't give a fuck what he wears, and you shouldn't either. Okay. right, we'll take a break when we come back. Amy Parnes wrote a pathetic article for The Hill about Obama, and The Guardian does a great profile on a minimum wage worker, or a low-wage worker, I should say. Stay right there. We'll be right back with all of that and much more.
We back.
Okay. All right, let's get into the pathetic corporate media. Amy Parnes wrote a pretty sad article for The Hill about President Obama. It's titled, "Democrats Long for Obama's Return." So here's what she says. "He's been out of office for nearly 8 months, but former President Barack Obama remains the Democratic Party's best weapon for 2018. Democrats are already nostalgic for Obama as they battle against President Trump's agenda. When he talks, they listen, as evidenced this week by a tweet from Obama about the violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, that became the most popular in the history of the platform. The tricky question now facing the party is how to use the former president on the campaign trail. Some Democrats are pushing for Obama to have a more elevated role. But Obama has made clear he is wary of sliding back into the role of party leader, which could prevent new leaders from emerging. Democrats acknowledge that being stuck in the Obama era is a concern, but say the party can't afford to have him on the sidelines." Quote, "Democrats badly need Barack Obama," said Brad Bannon, a Democratic strategist. "He offers such a vivid contrast to Trump in behavior and temperament. He always sounded reasonable and acted responsibly, even if you disagreed with him." Bannon continued, "None of the potential Democratic presidential candidates have the visibility or credibility to be effective." Okay. This is fucking infuriating. So the evidence that they're using to say Obama's the one we need is a tweet that got a lot of retweets and a lot of likes. That's their evidence. I was expecting, well, okay, they're going to go on and give, poll numbers and stuff like that. No. You know, if you actually went by something more detailed, more in-depth, like a poll, they'd be saying, Bernie Sanders is the only way the Democrats can go. Bernie Sanders is literally the most popular politician in the country. That's literal. Doesn't matter how you ask the question. When you go, who's the most popular senator? Bernie wins. Who's the most popular politician? Bernie wins. Who, when you ask in their respective states, Bernie wins. When you ask for the country, the entire country, Bernie wins. When you put him up against Trump, he wins by landslide. So, not just that, people say, but he's not a Democrat. He has been showing up to more Democratic events than any actual Democrats. He's been doing more for the party than Democrats. And you keep slapping him across the face. It's like they're trying to lose. And then notice the other argument they make. They say, look, he had a great tweet. Leader! Oh my God, leader! We need him! Okay, then they say he offers such a vivid contrast to Trump in behavior and temperament. Wow. Isn't that a slimy fucking argument? Why? Because look at when they're making this argument. What just happened? Trump announced he's going to increase troop levels in Afghanistan. What did Obama do? He increased troop levels in Afghanistan. So Obama continued the war, shouldn't have, but continued the war. Now Trump is doing the same fucking thing as Obama. And what's the Democrats' response? Obama, we need Obama. Wouldn't it be lovely if he was in there to continue the war and not Trump? No, it'd be great if we got the fuck out of the goddamn war. And then this really is just a spitting in the eye of Bernie Sanders when they say, none of the potential Democratic presidential candidates have the visibility or credibility to be effective. Not only is that untrue, Bernie is better than Obama in this respect. They're never going to learn, guys. And then they wonder, like, why is the Democratic base so angry? I don't get it. Why are they, like, booing Tom Perez at these DNC events? This is fucking why. Because you keep trying. It's a top-down approach. The elites, the establishment, the corporate Democrats, they try to force onto you who they want And who they want is directly linked in with what their corporate donors want. And you have a guy like Obama who gives you a little bit of change, but it's mostly doing the same old shit. It's mostly the same establishment shit. And yes, he does just bring a better temperament to the table. You know, yes, it's a very stark contrast from Trump. He is the polar opposite of Trump when it comes to temperament. But that's not the only thing that fucking matters. In fact, what matters way more is policy substance. And on policy substance, like when they say, he was very well-reasoned, even if you disagreed with Obama, he was very well-reasoned. Really? Tell that to all the people who died unnecessarily, all the civilians, in Obama's misguided drone strikes. 90% got the wrong target under Obama. You can't say something like that.
Even if you disagreed, it was always reasonable.
Really? Tell that to Edward Snowden, an American hero who's still hiding overseas. Don't give me that bullshit, man. This deification after the fact. Yes, he's better than Trump. That's not fucking hard. That's not hard. In fact, that's the easiest goddamn thing in the world. And they're saying he's the only way forward. No, that's the last direction you should go in. Because under Obama, what else happened? 1,000 seats the Democrats lost. 1,000 seats. That's under Obama, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi. And now these are the same people that the corporate Democrats are saying, we got to go in that direction. Why? You got wiped out. You got wiped out. I don't know if you noticed, the guy who Obama campaigned for, Hillary Clinton, got beaten by a guy with a 60% unfavorability rating. Perhaps going in a different direction is the right direction. Perhaps being more progressive, more liberal, more populist left. Actually fighting for Medicare for all and free college and ending the wars and a new New Deal and legalizing drugs. Ugh. It's just so goddamn frustrating, man. He's not the answer. He is part of the problem. Again, way better than Trump. Don't misunderstand me. Don't try to take it out of context. Clearly way better than Trump. But that doesn't say anything, man. That's so easy. That's such a low bar. And it's not like we haven't run the experiment of what a Democratic Party looks like under Obama. We know what that experiment looks like. We got Obamacare, for example. Step in the right direction. Nowhere near Medicare for all. Not even a public option. Lost 1,000 seats. Because the neoliberal, corporatist, centrist, you know, baby steps in the right direction, it wasn't fucking enough. People rather roll the dice on somebody who seemed like an anti-establishment crazy person who's going to shake shit up. Now, Trump wasn't that. It turns out he serves the establishment more than anybody. But people would rather roll the dice on that lunatic than continue with the status quo. And now you're hearing from the corporate media and the corporate Democrats, let's go back to status quo. No. The answer is Bernie Sanders' vision. The answer is Justice Democrats. JusticeDemocrats.com/fight. Okay. All right, now let's go to a very heartbreaking video. This is very important, though. I'll read for you the things that you guys can't see that are on the screen written. I will read for you. Okay, I just got to tell you that in advance of this story. The Guardian did a profile of a low-wage worker in Kansas City on the front lines of the fight for 15. And I want to play you the video here, and then we'll come back and discuss.
It's economic slavery. We are the foot soldiers for these billion-dollar companies. We are the ones that are generating the money. You know, so without us, you're not going to be making those billion dollars. People got to understand, we're not out here trying to get rich. We're just trying to survive. We're trying to survive like everybody else.
You work 6 days a week.
I come and I lay my head until the next morning. It humbles you because when I am blessed to get back on my feet, everything going, I won't take anything for granted. This is everything we own. our clothes, shoes.
It's in a van.
Suitcases. This is our, me and my family's prized possessions. It's all we own. My life is a routine. All I do is work. I mean, it's a struggle. Life is a struggle anywhere, though. Not just Kansas City, it's everywhere. You know, I put my parents on like everybody else. I go and punch the clock like everybody else. We work to provide for our families. There's no difference from us to a doctor. We still go to work like they do. We want to be treated equal, and we're not.
She suffers from depression and high blood pressure. And she doesn't have health insurance, so she hasn't seen a doctor as an adult.
I prayed before I got off the bus, and I know I got a job to do. I just pray that I work to the best of my ability.
Works at a Popeyes.
Go to work every day and still got to come home to decide whether I'm going to be able to put food on the table or if I'm going to pay the light bill or the gas bill or pay rent. It's tough.
So since she's homeless, her children are staying at her friend's house and she hasn't seen them in a week.
My kids always brighten up my soul. Like I tell people, at the end of the day, when the smoke clears, they're the only ones to be standing to my left and to my right. People be like, well, if it's that bad, why are you in it? I love what I do, and I'm damn good at it. Just like Martin Luther King said, if you want to be a street sweeper, be the best darn street sweeper there is. I love customer service, and I think I'm one of the best that there is. So, I don't know. It's just society's all messed up. The one thing I want to express to America is that this is our livelihood that we're fighting for. If we don't stand up and band together to fight and stand united, we aren't going to win. It's time for us to stand up and band together and fight for what we deserve. It's united we stand or divided we fall. That's it.
She's looking for a second job right now, and she's still homeless. Okay, so her name is Fran Marion. She works 6 days a week, but even though she works 6 days a week, she has no health insurance, and she's homeless. If you can't look at that and say right up front, okay, we have a problem here, because this isn't an individual failing on her part. You heard her. She's talking about hard work and, you know, I do the job to the best of my ability and I actually like what I do and all that stuff. So we're not talking about somebody who's lazy, who's a parasite, who's a moocher, who's like, you know, sitting back and saying, gimme, gimme, gimme. We're talking about somebody who works hard here, works 6 days a week, but she has no health insurance and she's homeless. You know, it's almost like the system is messed up, and it's not an individual failing. Huh? So she used to have a second job, and she lost that second job. Now, on top of that, the apartment she was staying in, apparently the building wasn't up to code, and the landlord didn't fix everything, so she was just kicked out of her apartment. So now her kids are living with a different friend of hers, and she's living with another friend of hers because they can't have that many people under one roof in each situation, so they have to live apart. And she's still working 6 days a week to try to pay the bills and take care of the kids. Look, man, for people who tell you their stories like this, and their solution is, can we have a living wage? Could we have $15 an hour? That's almost like too reasonable. It's almost too kind, and they're not going far enough. Because we do live in a country where you could work full-time and not make enough money to survive. And that's exactly what's going on here with Fran. working full-time, not making enough money to survive. So what? How can anybody argue that this is okay, the current facts? I don't know how anybody could argue that. And all the counter-arguments just are so pathetically dumb that it's hard to even discuss them seriously. Because what do some of the people on the right say?
Well, you know, she should work hard and try to get that promotion.
But, okay, there are millions of friends out there, and even if all of them work as hard as humanly possible, they can't all get a promotion. So the math just makes it so that some people are going to be making more at the lower end of the wages. So since that's the case, then the question becomes, are we going to pay those people at the lower end a living wage, yes or no? And some people answer no to that question. Now, to be fair, that's actually a very small minority in the country, because 80% of the American people want to raise the minimum wage. Fran doesn't make minimum wage. She makes $9.50. But that's still not enough to survive on, which is why she's fighting for $15 an hour. But you do have 80% of the American people who say raise the minimum wage. We're talking about Democrats, independents, and Republicans. So we all agree. So what's stopping it? What's preventing it? The answer is the corporations who have bought our government. They bought and own the politicians. So they're the only group of people in the country who say don't raise the minimum wage. And they're the ones who give the campaign contributions to the politicians, so the politicians do their bidding, and they don't raise the minimum wage. And then they have people like Fran in basically wage slavery. You work full-time, but you have no health insurance, you're homeless, and you can't, you know, pay the light bill, pay the gas bill, put food on the table. Totally unacceptable. We have to make the minimum wage a living wage and tie it to inflation. We have to fight for strong unions. We have to do a new deal. We have to get free college, Medicare for all. These things are not negotiable. And that's, you know, for what we're doing with Justice Democrats, that's our whole philosophy, is that this is, we're asking for the bare minimum here. We're asking for what could be viewed in an international context as just centrism. This is just a moderate approach to government. I mean, in Scandinavia, they're like, whoa, you don't have those things already? They look at us like we're fucking crazy, because we are crazy, because since we don't have those things, you get situations like this with Fran, and there are millions of Frans out there. Work full-time, work hard, don't make enough money to survive. Think about that, man. It's just so horrendous. So we got to fight back. We got to win. Look, we support Fight for 15. Justice Democrats has teamed up with Fight for 15 on a couple different projects. There's a real uniting going on right now among the actual left, not the corporate Democrats and their cronies and the Neo-Tandons of the world, but, you know, actual people on the left, Democratic Socialists, Fight for 15, Our Revolution, Justice Democrats, Brand New Congress, National Nurses United, and we're really fighting on these issues because, unlike many of the corporate Democrats, we're uncompromising. The whole point, the whole reason we're in it, is to help people like Fran and to get a living wage and to get Medicare for all. So support our effort because we can't afford to lose. We can't afford to lose. Hey, can you look at her story and say, yeah, let's do nothing? No, we got to work, man. We got to work and we got to win. JusticeDemocrats.com/fight. Let's do it. Okay. Okay, I think I'm going to take the final break now, and then when we come back, I have a lot. I have 5 important segments for you. So stay right there. Don't go anywhere. Park your butt in the seat, and we will be right back.
Well,
that real nigga left. The left. It's like I'm on an island by myself. The left. Please don't make me slap you with the left. The left. You will face so I'm gonna drop you with the left. The left. I feel like I'm the left real nigga left. The
son
left.
Of a bitch. Like all right, we're back here, buddy. Myself. The
left. Okay. What? The National Review is a right-wing magazine, and an author named Arthur Herman wrote an article in the wake of Charlottesville called "Confederate Statues Honor Timeless Virtues. Let Them Stay." Timeless virtues. That's interesting. By the way, the subtitle, which you can't see there, is "Don't Let Extremists on Both Sides Destroy Honor and Valor, Even as They Seek to Destroy Everything Else." So he's saying Confederate monuments stand for honor and valor. This, the revisionist history from these people is amazing. We actually covered the story the other day, and I was ignorant on it too, but I learned that apparently the Confederate statues went up at two time periods. Number one, the heart of Jim Crow. It was put up specifically to intimidate Black Americans. The second time that they put a bunch of them up, the Civil Rights Movement, specifically to intimidate Black Americans and let them know, hey, I know you're getting all uppity here and fighting for rights and whatnot, but guess what? Know your place. We're still in control. And this is a symbol of that right here. Monument of somebody who fought for your enslavement. So that's the purpose of it. I was naive. I was ignorant. I didn't know that. Now I learned that. And now, you know, to read stuff like this, you go, oh, so you're just making shit up, aren't you? Stands for honor and valor. Shut the fuck up with your bullshit. Okay, now I'm not going to go through the whole piece with you because I'd rather be waterboarded. But there's one key passage that's absolutely bonkers that I wanted to share. And it's getting, you know, a lot of eyeballs on the internet. So here's what he says. Quote, "It's true that Lee failed. His dream of a new South descended into Jim Crow after he died. This is, in fact, the best argument that those who want these statues gone can make. That the reconciliation between North and South was done on the backs of blacks, and that the end of Reconstruction and the rise of Jim Crow were the price America paid to have peace in the aftermath of the Civil War. From a historical point of view, it's almost convincing. Even though what American blacks suffered under segregation was nothing compared to what liberalism has inflicted on them since the 1950s, as it destroyed their families, their schools, and their young men and women's lives through drugs and guns and the gangster rap culture lifestyle, which really is a death style." He just quite literally argued that liberalism is worse for black people than Jim Crow. Segregation. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. Oh, so you want to, like, give people health care and, like, a living wage? Well, that's obviously worse than if you separate them and tell them they're inferior and give them their own water fountains and make sure that they're second-class citizens officially. How can anybody be this stupid? I don't get it. I don't get it. Do you know how many people have been lifted out of poverty by the Great Society? Do you have any idea? Like, we've actually covered in detail the stories previously on the show, where we get into the exact numbers and, okay, this program lifted this many millions of people out of poverty. This program lifted that many millions of people out of poverty. He goes, yeah, no, see, the problem is liberalism is worse than Jim Crow. It destroyed their families, their schools, their young men and women's lives through drugs and guns in the gangster rap culture lifestyle, which is really a death style. Wow. That liberalism, that's the problem. You nailed it, man. Which is why, you know, where they have social democracies, a more liberal system in Scandinavia, hellholes, disgusting places. I mean, all the health care, all the paid vacation, the living wages, it's really grotesque, man. They really got to clean their act up over there. liberalism is worse than Jim Crow. Can you imagine writing that and thinking you're a serious person and you're an intellectual? extremism isn't the word for this. This is beyond extremism. This is just like you're 2 IQ points away from riding on the short bus. Okay. All right, now let's go to some religion stuff. Oh, this story is something else. James Baker is a lunatic televangelist, and his fellow fundamentalist friend, Paula White, came on his show to talk about the president. And it was a festival of craziness.
We're more impressed with a Saul anointing than a David anointing, because we're more impressed with what looks right than what is right.
God
and
help
so,
us.
Therefore, we choose things that we think should sound right, should act right, according. And they even say about our president, well, he's not presidential. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
And I mean that with all due respect, because in other words, he's not a polished politician. In other words, he's authentically, whether people like it or not, has been raised up by God, because God says that he raises up and places all people in places
right.
of authority.
Right.
It is God that raises up a king. It is God that sets one
yes.
down. And so when you fight against the plan of God, you're fighting against the hand of God. We were not sent into this earth to fit in or just to, we weren't just sit here to be a part. We were sent here to take over.
Right. Are you listening?
That's
the church.
Oh.
That's why we have the president we have. He doesn't fit.
Amen.
He's not a normal president.
Amen.
And here's the woman who is from the bottom lands.
Yes.
But God has raised her up
yes.
to the White House.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's a picture with her and the president. And Trump actually talks to these people. I'm not kidding. That's real. He's tweeted out pictures of them in their weird fucking prayer meetings where they all got their hands on him and they're like, oh, zombie Jewish carpenter, let's transfer our magical powers into this man's orange face. Guys are so ridiculous. They believe in wizards. They believe in wizards and unicorns and Jigglypuff in space. I mean, that's what this is. And he talks to them. On a regular basis, he talks to them. And we've seen it with Alex Jones, too. He has conversations. Alex, at least Alex claims. Who knows? He could be making that shit up. But he's gone on Alex Jones' show before. But his ties to the evangelical community, you know, they're like this. That's Trump's base right there. That's the red meat, far-right Trump base that's never going to abandon him. Those are the people who make up the 61% of his supporters. We just covered the poll yesterday. That say, I will never change my mind, and I will always support him no matter what he does, which is fucking crazy. But you heard what you said there. He's put there by the hand of God. Really? God put Trump there? So I guess you're saying God just makes everything as it is. So that's weird. Why did you fight against Obama when Obama was president? Because God put Obama there by your own logic. God puts everything where it is. So God put Trump there. So God put Obama there too. So why did you fight against Obama? That's like you're fighting against God. Why do you hate God? They just, you notice how they change the rules just depending on what their own opinions are? So with Obama, they don't like him. So, oh my God, this is terrible. God wants him gone. What? With Trump? I like him, so God wants him there. It must be so easy in your own mind to feel like you've won an argument when your response to everything is just God. God's on my side, so God. So you can't have a rational conversation with a person because whenever you say anything, they're like, no, God disagrees. So anytime I say anything, God disagrees. Anytime you say something, God agrees. How fucking mighty convenient that is. And then they said fighting against God is fighting against Trump is fighting against the plan of God. It never occurs to them to think like, hey, wait a second, even if that were true, which it's not, that God put Trump there, how great is God? That of all the people in the world, all the fucking people, this is who he chooses. The fucking reality TV star caught on camera saying, I grab him by the pussy, I don't even wait. A guy who said, we have to take out their families. We have to take out their families. Talking about the families of terrorists. Not just the terrorists, the families. Kill the families of terrorists. A guy who said, let's bring back torture. This, he said, wages are too high. Is that what Jesus would do? Who's, you know, what low-wage worker would Jesus take money from? So this is, they really think that that has them win the argument. You're fighting against Trump, you're fighting against God. Well, you got us. I guess we can't fight against them. And then the scariest part is that we were sent here to take over. Point. That's creepy. Because that's like, hey, we're in charge here. We're running shit now. So get the fuck out of the way if you don't like it. Does it seem like they're going to be, you know, kind and open-minded and open-hearted to minorities and people who disagree philosophically? No. We were sent here to take over. So that means, you know, for example, gay marriage, they have a president here, forget gay rights. He's going to try to make as many decisions as possible against gay rights. You know, that's what these people believe in. When they say family values, that's what they mean. They mean go to church, be fucked up to gay people. Like, that's what they mean. They don't mean, hey, let's fight to make the minimum wage a living wage so that we help families. Of course they don't mean that. So this is the crowd that Trump runs with, and that's pretty telling. Okay, now, let's talk about the cops, what they're doing. So here's a national scandal that's not getting nearly enough attention. More video emerges, more video of Baltimore police staging evidence. Quote, more body-worn camera footage that shows Baltimore police officers apparently staging the discovery of evidence has emerged, a city prosecutor said on Monday, in the third such episode to become public in recent weeks. Third in a few weeks. In the previous two episodes, video showed officers apparently placing illegal drugs at crime scenes. The Baltimore Police Department said it was investigating charges that some officers were planting drugs to frame innocent people. But Police Commissioner Kevin Davis has also said he could not rule out that the officers were wrongly staging more cleanly shot reenactments of drugs actually found at the scene. The latest video to come to light was self-reported as a reenactment of the seizure of evidence by the police department. The Office of the State's Attorney for Baltimore said in a statement, the police department did not respond to questions on Monday. That video has not been made public, and the statement did not say if the third episode also involved drugs, nor did it say how many officers were involved. The officers are witnesses in about 100 cases, both ongoing and closed, that are being re-examined by prosecutors. So far, 43 active cases have been dismissed. Another 22 will proceed as planned, while about 36 cases will be reviewed for problems. Wow, isn't that amazing, this story? So I think a lot of people, probably myself included, were pretty naive and thought like, okay, planting drugs, sure, you see shit like that in movies and stuff, but how common is it really? Well, now we learned the Baltimore Police Department, this is the third time in recent weeks that they have it on video. And this is a clear example of the video cameras being very useful. Now, the video cameras sometimes they don't stop shit. Like, they can record a horrific act, and there's still no punishment. Look at Eric Garner. But it does show that cops are more likely up front to not do messed up stuff when they know they're being recorded. Now, in this case, they were either super brazen or they forgot they were being recorded. So they did this. But this is an enlightening moment, an eye-opening moment for a lot of Americans where they go, oh, shit, Because I think black Americans, when they hear this, they go, yeah, duh. But I think a lot of white Americans probably go, I don't think they're planting stuff. And then they see this and they're like, oh, shit, you guys got it on tape? So it shows quite a bit. Now, again, this isn't to smear all cops. Of course not. But we are talking about a police department, the Baltimore Police Department, which has a significant number of problems. Just like, remember the report that came out a while back about the Chicago Police Department? They literally had torture sites. The feds did a long, detailed accounting of all the problems in the Chicago Police Department, and it was really amazing stuff. Where, yes, there was a systemic problem in that particular department. There was the Alabama Police Department recently that was retweeting Richard Spencer, white supremacist Richard Spencer. That could be a little problem. And then here, I mean, and their dodge is fucking unbelievable. The police commissioner, yeah, you know, I can't rule out that maybe it was like a really good, high-quality enactment or something, reenactment. You know, like every now and then you just plant some drugs, but you're doing it for the lulz, and you're doing it to show your fellow officers, hey, man, when I came here, I saw the drugs like that, and so I'm going to put them back where I saw them, and this is a reenactment of how I found them. See, is what I have. Shut the fuck up. Who the fuck are you kidding? Who are you kidding? So, it's just sad, man, and there should be justice. Everybody who's involved in shit like this, fire them. All these cases are suspect. I mean, yeah, you want to talk about reexamining them. But also, please spare me with the, oh, we're doing an internal investigation. Fuck your internal investigation. Are you kidding? That's like having the criminals on Wall Street do fraud on a massive scale, and then they turn around and go, it's okay, don't worry, we got this shit on lock. We're going to do an internal investigation. I'm supposed to trust the findings when you're looking into your own wrongdoings? Fuck out of here, son. So I would have the feds get involved in this immediately and bring justice immediately. Dismiss the cases that need to be dismissed. Fire these officers. Take whatever appropriate action to make sure stuff like this does not happen again, because this is 100% unacceptable. Okay, now I got two stories left. Remember how I talked yesterday about how I got the water in my ear? I still do. It's really fucking annoying, I must say. Okay, two stories left. They're both very important stories. Let's do the one on the pain pill situation. RT did something that I don't think I've seen almost at all on TV in the U.S. They got the other side of the pain pill epidemic that you haven't heard about. So let's watch and then we'll discuss.
Bill Hackett, who has been prescribed opioids long-term for his condition. So Bill, you were diagnosed with degenerative disc disease in your 20s. You're now in your 40s and have had to have surgery after a disc ruptured a few years back and another one in 2013. So now lawmakers are trying to limit opioid prescriptions so people won't become addicted, which is a good thing, but your case is different. You're more of a long-term user with your diagnosis. Tell us where you think lawmakers are going wrong when it comes to this battle of addiction.
Well, the way that they're trying to control this is really going through and limiting the supply. And they're also going through and setting things up so that doctors are now becoming afraid to prescribe. The actual prescription rate for opioids from 2015 to 2016 actually decreased. The DEA had actually reduced the amount of opioids that drug manufacturers could produce by 25% for 2016 and 17, and now they're talking about cutting it another 25% for 2018. And in addition to that, they're actually setting up through these guidelines that the CDC has put out that talk about things like mandatory drug testing, weaning people off, or discontinuing altogether. You know, it gets to a point where that pain is so great that you really start to question whether or not you should go on. you know, partially because it's unbearable, and partially because of the burden that you're putting onto your family, because you literally can't do anything. You know, you essentially become bedridden and not a whole lot better than someone who's in a coma. Going through this process, though, as I hear more and more really attacks in the war on opioids, which really is punishing the patients, you know, I discovered in a recent survey that 78% of chronic pain patients in a survey that was done earlier this year with over 3,000 respondents, 78% of them said that the suicide rate's going to go up, and 42% of them had said that they had personally contemplated it, and doctors also answered their survey. There was about 300 medical professionals, and 58% of them said that they had had discussions with patients who were contemplating suicide. And unfortunately, 10% of all the medical professionals who answered the survey said that they'd actually lost at least one or more patients to suicide, and it's all related to pain and their access, you know, through having them cut down or weaned off or just abruptly discontinued.
It's so unfortunate.
And it's sad.
And it seems as though a lot of people who use opioids might be put in a certain category, and clearly you're not wanting to get high or anything like that. You just want to manage your pain so you can spend time with your family and kind of, you know, live the best normal life that you possibly can.
Correct, and to be perfectly honest with you, you know, myself, and I think a lot of other chronic pain patients who take these medications, we don't really understand the high that people get from them. You know, when we take this medication, it's just waiting a little while later, and it helps damp down our pain. You know, there's nothing psychotropic or psychedelic or, you know, anything that we've noticed other than the fact that it helps your pain be manageable.
So this is the collateral damage in the crackdown from the feds on pain pills because of the epidemic of abuse of them. I mean, I bet you haven't heard this story. You'll hear a zillion stories about, oh, my God, the addiction to pain pills and all the problems and the destroyed lives as a result of that. You don't hear this side of it, do you? The people who are like, hey, the new guidelines that the federal government just released and said doctors need to abide by this. Well, doctors are now swinging the pendulum in the other direction, and they're way too strict with giving out the prescriptions for this. So you have some chronic pain patients who can't get the medication that they need. And then when they can't get the medication they need, there's, you know, more suicides as a result of that. There's pushing people to the black market to turn to heroin because that's all that they can get that kills their fucking pain. And then guess what? You'll have a spike in overdoses from heroin because when it's made on the street, it's of course not it's not quality, and it can be cut with, you know, lethal products. So they're going about it the wrong way. I mean, look at this guy. He's telling you. He's saying it's harder for people to get it now. They're cutting back on the supply. When you cut back on the supply in this dragnet that you're using, you're going to get a lot of chronic pain patients. And he said, quote, sometimes you question whether or not you should go on. How many people in the country feel like this as a result of what's happened, as a result of the crackdown? This is not the right way to go about it. Now, I've discussed it before. I think drugs should be legal, taxed, and regulated. And, you know, he's talking about, we're talking here about a legitimate pain patient who says, look, I don't even get high from it. Because that's the way it works. When you're in a lot of pain and you take opioids, you're just going to feel normal. But when you feel normal and you take opioids, you're going to feel high. Like, that's the way it works. So this guy has been punished by a policy that was attempting to solve a problem where they overreached. And like I said, I think these drugs should be legalized, taxed, and regulated. I do think that in some instances you're going to have people who do abuse them and do overdose on them, but I honestly look at that in the same way that I look at alcohol and alcohol abuse. Alcohol is legal. There's a lot of alcohol abuse. Sometimes people die from drinking too much alcohol. Amy Winehouse died from basically the withdrawal from alcohol when she stopped cold turkey. So alcohol is very, very dangerous, but we have it legal. In the case of alcohol, you're not even talking about medicinal use. You're just talking about recreational use. But we have it legal, and we say, you know what? Even though there's many downsides, it should be legal because you should have the right to kind of put that in your body if you want to put that in your body. I filed these pain pills in the same category, and also you would see a giant tick down in the overdoses from heroin if you were to have these legal pain pills. Now, you could put every warning on them in the world, you know, but there are going to be some people who get addicted, and when they get addicted, I think the answer is we should have nationwide treatment programs. Same thing for any substance. You know, the answer is not to lock people up. The answer is not to put them in jail or prison. The answer is to give them treatment. So we should legalize, tax, and regulate, have treatment centers all over the country. I mean, it's the only approach that makes sense. And also make it so life's easier for guys like this, especially people who've been swept up in this unnecessary crackdown. And I've heard from these people, because people have seen, I've done previous segments similar to this on this topic, and I've had people contact me and say, thank you, man, for speaking out, because nobody talks about us. Like, think about the rhetoric around marijuana at this point. Now the rhetoric on marijuana has flipped, and everybody goes, okay, enough with the hysteria and the madness, and like, okay, people want to smoke it, they should be able to smoke it. Furthermore, there's a lot of people who use it for genuine medicinal reasons, and come on, government, get the fuck off of people's back, stop taking away their freedom. But the rhetoric on the pain pills is the exact opposite. The hysteria is, you know, cranked up to 11, and people are saying, oh my God, so many people dying, so many people overdosing. Don't even have a conversation about the people who will tell you that the pain pills saved their lives and stopped their pain. Don't talk to them. Let them get swept up in the crackdown and in the dragnet as collateral damage, and then let's act like they don't exist and there's only downsides to the pain pills. That's just not true. And now you're finally getting the story of somebody who's directly affected by this, who's a pain pill patient, who's saying, whoa, you're going about this the wrong way, and you're making victims out of people like me, and there are many people who are going to commit suicide as a result of this, and many people who you're unnecessarily hurting. So this is the pain pill epidemic you won't hear about. And by the way, the world over, there's also a pain pill epidemic. It's not the abuse of them. It's not having them. There's many countries where they don't have enough of them, and people are laying in a bed with stage 4 cancer in pain, moaning all day long, and they can't even numb their pain. So this is the side of the story you won't hear, and that's why Secular Talk is here. We're here to hopefully give you all the context and all the perspective, and then you can make your own decision about what you think makes the most sense. Okay. All right, now let's go to Yemen. Final story of the day. PBS Frontline did a superb piece on the Saudi destruction of Yemen and our role in it. Let's watch.
When we were in Yemen in May of 2017, we were the only foreign journalists that were able to get permission to visit the country. We wanted to come in and see the consequences of the 2+ years of airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition. You have the region's wealthiest country bombing the region's poorest, and people are not seeing what's going on. We're talking thousands of civilian dead. We came into town. What struck me right away was the amount of garbage on the streets. The garbage workers hadn't been paid in 8 months. The rains came, washing through the garbage, bacteria carried into the water supply, people drinking bad water, and they were hit by a cholera epidemic. Simply dehydrates you quickly so that anything you ingest, any water you drink or food you eat, just completely passes through your system and you get no nutrients out of it. thousands gathered to protest the arrival of President Trump in Riyadh, where he announced his intention to approve a $110 billion arms package to the Saudis.
Respect the United States of America, and we hold a respect in our hearts, but we came here in order to express our outrage against the United States policy.
It was pretty evident that we were an American TV crew, but absolutely no hostility was directed at us. There was only a sense that our government was to blame, and ordinary Yemenis want the world to be aware of what's going on.
Civilian death toll is over 10,000. That's what it says there on the... So we arm Saudi Arabia as they absolutely obliterate Yemen and kill civilians. They've bombed markets. They've bombed hospitals. They've bombed schools, mosques. Schools for the blind as well. Stay classy. All the while this is going on in Yemen, the Saudi king is taking a vacation in Morocco. It's a $100 million vacation. I've never seen a stronger symbol of immorality than this. And by the way, they're also starving the country, to be clear. They do a blockade, so all medicines can't get in, food can't get in, people are starving to death. So many babies have severe malnutrition and are dying from it. So they're starving a country, they're bombing a country, they're recklessly and ruthlessly killing people, civilians all over the place. And all the while, the king is on a $100 million vacation. You think maybe it's time for the United States to stop arming this monstrous regime? I'll let you guys answer that question. Okay. Out of time, guys. I love you, baby. Kyle and Corin tomorrow. You know the deal. I'll see you back here on Thursday. Okay. Much love. Everybody enjoy the rest of your day. Peace.